KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
Welcome to the Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature and the human heart.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
Healing is a fundamental part of getting to a place of stopping the othering and building those places of belonging so that we can effectively build those bridges without those coming after us and, you know, cutting those lines just as we connect them. And the courage that it takes to be like, I'm going to do this out of love.
In the context of a world where authoritarianism, where ethnic nationalism is sweeping the globe, it sounds sentimental to be talking about belonging. That's the major story we're fighting about. Do we have a large we, where everybody belong, where whales belong, where children belong? And I don't care if they're from Syria, or they're from Mexico, or if they're from Kansas, but everybody belongs.
In this program, racial justice advocates Ariel Deranger, John A. Powell, and Anita Sanchez explore how overcoming the illusion of separateness from nature and each other requires building bridges rather than burning them. They say the fate of the world depends on it. This is Reweaving the Web of Belonging. The inside is not, and the outside is too. I'm Neil Harvey. I'll be your host. Welcome to The Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature. As author Michael Pollan observes, quote, the two biggest crises humanity faces today are tribalism and the environmental crisis. They both involve the objectifying of the other, whether that other is nature or other people, unquote. So how do we reweave that web of relationships and focus on our likenesses rather than our differences? Professor John A. Powell of UC Berkeley's Othering and Belonging Institute says it's really complicated and undeniably imperative. In that question hangs the fate of the world as we know it. John A. Powell is an internationally recognized scholar and activist in the areas of civil rights, structural racism, and democracy. He's the author of Racing to Justice, Transforming Our Concepts of Self and Other to Build an Inclusive Society. John A. Powell spoke on a panel at a Bioneers conference.
And there are two big stories. And one story is about a smaller and smaller we. In fact, sometimes that we get so small, it stops being a we altogether, becomes an I. And we actually have a word for it. We call it narcissism. Where everything is about me or my little group. Everything else that's outside of me and my group is seen as a threat. Mm-hmm. And the way I deal with that threat is to dominate. And so we divide the world up, not just for nomenclature, but for deciding who gets dominated and who the dominators. The story of humans in this small we is the humans are here to dominate, control, exploit. And that's the dominant story we still live with. And we actually have another name for it. That story is called capitalism. Mm-hmm. Everything's to be taken, to be used. And he says, so what happens when it's all used up? Well, there are other planets. We can go someplace. We can literally break from the earth and start all over again. So that's the dominant theme. It's not just a story. We organize our whole economy around it. Mm-hmm. We organize our structures around it. And once you start looking for it, you see it everywhere. So literally, up until the late 60s, we had, in many, many states, not only were we separating people based on their race, we're saying it's against the law, it's a crime for people of different races to marry.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Many of you weren't born in the 60s, but we have large numbers of people running around the country today reasserting, not implicitly, not if my friend Ian Henny Lopez would say, not a dog whistle, but with a bullhorn, saying, we need to restore white supremacy, white nationalism. We need to dominate. There grew more and more people in the United States who say, what is this thing equality? We don't believe in equality. It's natural for people to be with their own. And their own is this small race, religion, this small we. What comes from that is putting kids in cages. Yeah. And literally, you have people saying, those are not our kids. They don't belong here. And we're doing it over and over and over and over and over and over again. That's the major story we're fighting about. Do we have a large we where everybody belongs? Where whales belong, where children belong, and I don't care if they're from Syria, or they're from Mexico, or if they're from Kansas, but everybody belongs. That's a really important but radical concept. In the context of a world where authoritarianism, where ethnic nationalism is sweeping the globe, it sounds sentimental to be talking about belonging. It sounds quaint to be saying we care about the earth. When there are 80 trillion or 700 trillion dollars worth of fossil fuel still buried, why would you leave it in the ground? Okay, so you're going to mess up the earth. But we could take that $700 trillion and go to Mars. F the earth. And what's our response? How do we bridge? When do we bridge? It's very easy to say, if they're going to F us, we're going to F them. If they're going to break with us, we're going to break with them. If they say, we don't belong, we're going to say, you don't belong. Notice, when we're doing that, we're adopting their framework. And I don't say to anyone who's been abused, been traumatized, if they want to fight back, if they want to be angry, and sometimes it's appropriate to be angry, I don't say not be angry. But I say, we can't stay there.
It's complicated indeed. The ancient tribal instincts we carry as human beings no longer serve us. Not in an irretrievably interconnected world that gets smaller by the day, nor in a globally shared biosphere that we've broken by objectifying and exploiting. We've institutionalized the structures of dominators and dominated. We've built our economy and society on them. How do we build bridges rather than burn them? How do we change our societal pronoun from me, 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 to we? Again, John A. Powell.
One of the things about healing, you know, you hear a lot about self-care. Very small in the larger scheme of things. You can only do so much for yourself. Mm-hmm. If you're doing all your care by yourself, it's sad. Mm-mm. It is sad. Care really requires a community.
Correct.
Absolutely. You know, I participate in a lot of mindful practice, and people will say, you know, it's like, first, do your work inside. And I always come back with Don Cherry, who's a beautiful jazz musician, and he used to say, the inside is not, and the outside is too. Yes, exactly. What he's saying is that duality between inside and outside is problematic. And healing, in part, is bridging with yourself. What we do, and when we're broken, literally, think about it, when we're really struggling, we say we're broken, meaning that we no longer belong to ourselves. And we do that not in sequence, not sitting down in a cave by myself. It's like we do it in relationship. And part of what bridging requires is space to hear and engage in what's called empathetic and compassionate listening.
Yeah.
Now, again, we're suspicious of that. Like, this person just did something terrible to me. I don't want to hear from them. Mm-hmm. I don't want to know about their suffering. Mm-hmm. I'm pushing them outside the circle of humanity. And there are these wonderful stories of people who have suffered a lot and use their suffering as a bridge. And I say, because this is hard work, and because, let's start off building short bridges. You know, don't go to the most extreme. And some of you heard me say when I talked to Pastor Mike, when he says, do I have to bridge with the devil? Mm-hmm. And my response is, don't start there. But also be careful who you call the devil.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we know deep down inside, there is no other. So if I'm cutting myself off from someone, for whatever reason, I'm cutting myself off from myself.
Yes.
And that's the deep, profound spiritual work.
Yes.
So we have a we. And if the we does not become real, if belonging does not become real, the bad news is then the we does not survive.
For those people seeking to build bridges where angels fear to tread, often it's the hellish predicament of damned if you do and damned if you don't. What do you do when your own group attacks or shuns you for reaching out to bridge with the other? And what if there's plenty good reason to be suspicious and defensive? As an indigenous person, Ariel Deranger has often found herself caught in that crossfire. She's a member of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation. She comes from a family of indigenous rights advocates fighting for the recognition, sovereignty, and autonomy of their indigenous lands and territory in Canada. She co-founded Indigenous Climate Action and serves as executive director. She spoke at a Bioneers conference.
And it's so hard to build those bridges. And I know as an Indigenous woman from Canada, a lot of folks think Canada is like super, oh, you guys have great relations with your government. Indigenous people are so well represented. That's like a fallacy. There's this appearance that there's this construction of a bridge happening that never actually gets worked on. And so over the years, we've seen this disenchantment from Indigenous folks not feeling like there's a sincere effort to build those bridges with us. And like that question is, who builds these bridges? Who takes the lead? Who takes on those responsibilities? And a lot of the folks that are invested, that are like making profit off of the marginalization of others, whoever those others are, and it's diverse in wherever you are. And those others can also be other beings, you know? It's, let's be real. This isn't just about humanity. The othering of other species as if those lives are less valuable. By sort of default, humanity has already othered ourselves from the rest of the natural world. And I feel like that's a huge challenge. And as an Indigenous person in Canada, navigating these places where a lot of my family, you know, I'm the first generation to not be ripped out of my family's home and forced into a residential school or the boarding schools that they had in the United States. I'm the first generation. And so when you think about the trauma, the intergenerational trauma of like being fearful, not just of white people, like let's be real, fearful of the education system, fearful of systems of government, fearful of participating in those systems because they will take everything that makes you away. And so that you break and you divide and you put yourself like into these little boxes and you hide and you protect what you still have. And then when you step outside of those things, those people that hold all that trauma and pain, first they say, don't do it. And then when you do it, they say, oh no, now you're not a part of us. And so you end up in these struggles of like, how do you actually take the steps to build the bridge when there's so much hurt and there's so much trauma that is blocking the ability to build these bridges?
Broken systems, broken people, broken trust in a broken world. It's a tough gig that gets even tougher when people translate their wounds into broken systems of domination and power. Ariel Deranger says the question becomes, how do we heal?
It can be really hard when you have these traumas and these things that separate us. Mm-hmm. They separate us because things have been broken. You know, we've been broken. The traumas create these fears. And then that perpetuates into if you have positions of power and domination and, you know, you enact oppression. And that can actually, that's where the break happens. The break happens when you actually deny the right for someone to belong to those groups, to the societies. And that's where the struggle comes on how we have to overcome these traumas. Healing is a fundamental part of getting to a place of stopping the othering and building those places of belonging so that we can effectively build those bridges without those coming after us and, you know, cutting those lines as we just as we connect them. And the courage that it takes to be like, I'm going to do this out of love, not out of strategy, not out of all of these things, but to come from it, from the love for me and the work that I do is, I do this for the love of my people. I take on these challenges and I put myself oftentimes in harm's way for the love of my people. I receive backlash from my own community. And then when I sit in those spaces where I'm told I don't really belong, I receive backlash from there as well. But I continue to move forward because I know at the root of this, the bridges that we're building, and you find those allies that say, I want to build those bridges too. And then suddenly you start to build these little tiny bridges, these little tentacles. And you're right, it's not like a linear thing. It's more like a web. It's like there's all these little pieces where you find this here, and then here, and then here.
When we return, we hear from author Anita Sanchez on forgiveness as an act of transformation that can expand our circle of belonging. This is Reweaving the Web of Belonging on the Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature. You can explore more Bioneers radio programs, podcasts, and videos online and learn about the National Bioneers Conference at bioneers.org or call 1-877-BIONEER. For Anita Sanchez, the political became deeply personal at a young age. Today, as a highly experienced professional at the top of the game, working in the areas of diversity and inclusion, leadership, and indigenous wisdom, she attributes her work to the trauma of the race-based murder of her father. How do you forgive the unforgivable?
As that little 13-year-old whose father was killed, murdered, he was an alcoholic, so he went every day to get a drink after work. After shoveling coal, he would go and get a beer. But that day in 1967, earlier that day in that corner bar, a white man and a black man were having a fight. And my father shows up in the afternoon. The white man returns and he just sees my dark-complected father in the same chair and fires several bullets through his head and kills him on the spot. Now, I'm a 13-year-old. What am I supposed to do with that? Mm-hmm. That was bad enough, but what happened the week after is the white woman and a little white boy who was probably about 13, too, came to the door and introduced themselves as the wife and the son of the man who murdered my father, and I was with my mom. And she said, I had to come tell you, Ms. Sanchez, you needed to know my husband was a good man. He never would have killed your husband if he knew he was Mexican and Native American. He thought he was black. And she started going on about what black people were. And my mom was very earth, indigenous, but also very Catholic. And I remember her shaking. She just yelled at a stranger. I never saw her do that, telling her, stop. You don't even know what you're saying. You don't even know the kind of hatred you're teaching your son, but you get off my porch. I'm going to try really hard to pray for your soul, but you get off my porch. Mm-hmm. What after over time, listening to these white people talking, they were sharing stories that their parents taught them they were better than us. Mm-hmm. But they were also dealing with their own healing. And they were slowly, not fast enough for me, but changing some behaviors and policies and programs. And I'm watching, and there weren't just flaky things, some major things were happening. And so I invite you to do the work, because there's a lot of goodies that come, like, why do I want to go into that suffering? Well, because it's freedom. What I found is by using the gift of forgiveness, the gift of healing, is that I'm able to be in unity with other, belong to many more. That illusion of separateness in my own separate wall comes down. Oh my gosh, it not only keeps out the bad things, it keeps out the good things. I wouldn't know these people or you. So be about your healing and be hungry for it, because it is possible. That's what I say. At this point, it's going to sound crazy and I'm going to pass it. I truly believe and know for me, there is absolutely nothing that is unforgivable. Absolutely nothing that can't be healed. Absolutely nothing that we can't do if we really are fully in it in unity. We make it sound really heavy, and it is heavy. There's heavy stuff, but there's a joyful light part. I never go anywhere. I'm never alone. I get lonely, but I am never alone, because that hoop of life only knows we. Well, I saw the loss. I saw what happens when we really hate each other.
There is nothing that cannot be healed, says Anita Sanchez, if we are fully in unity, in community. And as Mohandas Gandhi said, an eye for an eye will make the world blind. But it's still really complicated. As they say in the sports world, no pain, no gain. Yet most people have an aversion to pain and suffering and to facing our fears, even if it may mean our ultimate freedom and greater peace. How do you reconcile these opposing forces? Ariel Deranger says that peaceful coexistence acknowledges our unity, but it also requires healthy boundaries, self-protection, and a supportive community.
We often have this aversion to conflict, to pain. We want to minimize and mitigate our lives to be as painless and hurt-free as possible. But the reality is we need to be challenged in order to grow. And sometimes those challenges come with pain and adversity, and we need them. We also have to talk about like how we protect ourselves. I see people put themselves in harm's way too much, having too much empathy that leads to them being abused or manipulated. And we have to be very careful about taking care of self, but recognizing that self is part of community. There's this really great book, I've read it like three times, it's called Joyful Militancy.
Yes.
And it's really about like how we absolutely have to be prepared for those to challenge our perceptions, even to challenge our core values. And that we have to like not limit ourselves into those little silos, and that we have to bridge those divides. But we also have to be careful that yes, that nothing is unforgivable, but that doesn't mean you need to have it in your life.
Yes, exactly.
You know, you don't invite your abuser to live in your home, but you can forgive them. It's not simple like, oh, we just need to have full compassion and open our doors to everyone. And if you're not compassionate and you don't want to accept me for my mistakes, even though I've hurt you over and over again, then you're not doing this right. That's not it at all. There's the need to create your own boundaries for your own like preservation of self so that you don't get traumatized, so you don't lead to those disconnections that actually will other you. And again, we need community in order to navigate these things with health and with grace.
As John A. Powell says, don't start by trying to bridge with the devil. Yet in many ways, that's exactly what Nelson Mandela faced in South Africa. A life-and-death war against the colonial apartheid system founded in blood-soaked racial hatreds and divisions, othering of the highest order and the lowest depravity.
Nelson Mandela's in prison in South Africa, and he's head of the ANC, which is fighting a war against the Afrikaners. So it's not a good situation. And literally, he's having family members killed by the South Africans. So he has reasons to be very concerned and a lot of anguish and suffering. There's a big riot in South Africa, and Soweto is sort of the heart of it, the Soweto riots. The issue that was the issue that was focused on was the Afrikaners decided that the instructions would be done in Afrikaner. So everyone would have to learn the oppressive language in order to go to school. And the people of South Africa, the blacks in South Africa, said no way, and they start rioting. At the same time, Nelson Mandela is asking his prison guards in Robben Island to teach him Afrikaner. And they do. And a couple of things happen. So one, when the prison guards start teaching him Afrikaner, they actually start trying to soften his position in prison. They're saying, you no longer have to break rocks. we actually begin to see your humanity, so you don't have to do all these terrible things. And he says, no, make no differentiation between me and all the other people in prison. So if you say no one has to break rocks, that's fine, but I will not accept special treatment. He's getting up in age already. And then he comes out of prison, and he meets with the president of South Africa. They're meeting about a ceasefire to stop the war that's killing thousands and thousands of people. And the president says, I think we can possibly do this, but first, you have to meet with the general who's head of the Afrikaner army and convince him. Now, this general has actually called black South Africans monkeys. He says they're not human. He don't believe they can govern themselves, and he believed the whites can win the war. But he has to meet with Nelson Mandela. So he goes to Nelson Mandela's house, and Nelson Mandela's servants let him in. He sits on the couch. In front of the couch, there's a coffee table, and on the other side of the coffee table, there are chairs. And Nelson Mandela doesn't sit in the chairs. He comes and sits next to the general on the couch. The general is very uncomfortable. And Nelson Mandela says, would you like some tea? And the general says, yes. Nelson Mandela does not call his servants, and he has servants, to fix the tea. Nelson Mandela gets up, goes into the kitchen and fixes the general's tea, and comes back and serves him tea. This makes the general even less comfortable. And so the general said, look, I'm here to talk about a ceasefire. I think it's a terrible idea, but let's talk about it. And Nelson Mandela says, fine. So for the next 2 to 3 hours, they have a conversation about the ceasefire. The entire conversation takes place in Afrikaner. The general leaves Nelson Mandela's house, and his entourage says, how did it go? And he says, I don't like this Nelson Mandela guy, but he can convince anybody of anything. He agrees to the ceasefire. By some accounts, he saved over 100,000 lives. Mm-hmm. When Nelson Mandela is sick and dying, the general comes forward and goes to Nelson Mandela's family, and he says, I'd like to make a eulogy for Nelson Mandela. His family has not forgiven this general, but they can't completely refuse. And they says, you got 15 minutes. The general gives the eulogy for Nelson Mandela in Xhosa, Nelson Mandela's native language. And there are a lot of stories like this. This is bridging. So the hurt wasn't gone. Now, one thing to remember, Nelson Mandela had not laid down his arms. He still had an army. He was still willing to fight. He was still willing to protect himself. But he also was willing to bridge. And so it's not sequential. It's a complicated, messy process, but it's real.
John A. Powell, Ariel Duranger, and Anita Sanchez. Reweaving the web of belonging. The inside is not, and the outside is too. Executive producer Kenny Ossibel. Written by Kenny Ossibel. Senior producer and station relations Stephanie Welch. Host and consulting producer Neil Harvey. Producer Teo Grossman. Program engineer and music supervisor Emily Harris. I invite you to join the Bioneers in inspiring a shift to live on Earth in ways that honor the web of life, each other, and future generations. My name is Neil Harvey. Thank you for listening. This is program number 242.
Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the program.
It's an irony of our calendar that by the time Lollobrigida swings around once again in its reassuring way, bringing with it the promise of longer days and of nature renewing itself, our own personal attempts to begin afresh and reinvent ourselves have probably failed yet again. For by now, most of those New Year resolutions we made at the end of December have been quietly shelved, packed away for another year, like the Christmas decorations. Just as St. Augustine wanted to be made pure, but not just yet, most of us, despite wanting to be improved versions of ourselves, have happily yielded to our favourite sources of temptation. Perfection has been postponed. Still, the desire to reinvent ourselves seems to lie at the heart of what we are. What else could explain the surge in gym memberships in January, or the stampede to enroll in language classes in September? The belief that we can remake ourselves in 8 or 12 weeks is the product of the delusion that we are perfectible, rather than being, in fact, permanently flawed. At some level, we are persuaded there is another, truer version of ourselves, waiting to be summoned forth from the shadows, one that can bench press our own body weight while speaking fluently in Italian or Japanese. This notion of there being multiple versions of ourselves is perhaps what Yeats was getting at with his belief that the poet and the man were two separate entities. The poet, he wrote, is never the bundle of accident and incoherence that sits down to breakfast. I suppose he meant that the sausages and black pudding are consumed by the man, though it is hard to picture Yeats eating a sausage. The poet, on the other hand, Yeats says, is an ideal, something intended, complete. And this is true of many celebrities. Anyone who attends table quizzes with any regularity knows that Elton John was born Reginald Dwight and that John Wayne was originally Marion Morrison. And while technically Elton and Reg Dwight are one and the same, it's obvious that the flamboyant performer with a weakness for ludicrous glasses singing Tiny Dancer is the stellar Elton, rather than the earthbound Reg. Similarly, it's the rugged John Wayne, rather than the gender-ambiguous Marion Morrison, who drags the lovely Maureen O'Hara 5 miles across the fields in The Quiet Man. Reg Dwight, Marion Morrison, yes, yeah, sometimes we all need to be reinvented. F. Scott Fitzgerald understood this need for reinvention. The central moment of The Great Gatsby is when the opportunistic James Gatz sheds his skin and transfigures into glamorous J. Gatsby. The 17-year-old Gatz notices Bill Cody's luxury yacht moored at a dangerous spot. It was James Gatz who had been loafing along the beach that afternoon, but it was already J. Gatsby who borrowed a rowboat and informed Cody that a wind might break him up in half an hour. For Gatz, the rest, you might say, is fiction, complete fiction. Such extreme forms of reinvention are not confined to literature. Micheál MacLiomore, actor, director, writer, and professional corkman, entertained the country for more than 50 years with his talent and wit. His mellifluous speaking voice, fluent Irish, and general carry-on suggested a childhood spent frolicking along the highways and byways of the Cork countryside in the company of bards and shanachie. The truth, however, is that, like Gatsby, MacLiomore sprang from his platonic conception of himself. Originally Alfred Wilmore, born in the London suburb of Willesden, he decided at 17, the same age that James Gatz decided to become Gatsby, that he would much prefer to be Irish. So he set about learning the language, came to Ireland with a fictional family history and a new name. Micheál MacLiomore was born. In our annual attempts at reinvention, most of us have neither the determination nor the grand vision of Gatsby or MacLiomore. We make do with modest proposals that involve shedding a few pounds rather than an entire identity. By February, many of us have cheerfully accepted failure. We've reverted to being slightly overweight bundles of accident and incoherence. Yet, next December, a voice will call out and urge us on again into the following year. That voice sounds irritatingly like Beckett's in Worcester at Hoe. Ever tried, ever failed. No matter. Try again. Fail again. Fail better.
Slip sliding away, slip sliding away. You know the nearer your destination, the more you slip sliding.
Today I went for a run. It's my 14th day in a row of running. I don't run far and I don't run fast, but I run. If possible, I run in the morning, early, before work. This sets you up for the day and results in a smug glow which follows you around until at least lunchtime, if not beyond. I run laps of the small green in front of my house, in an estate of a Dublin suburb. I do this even in the rain, and I no longer care what the neighbours think, as I did when I started running. I run out of my estate, along the road and around Pierce Park, where I am met by historical artefacts and signposts telling me about Ireland's founding fathers, a history I wasn't taught during my school years in England. I run past the school that my children didn't get into due to oversubscription. At the height of my enthusiasm, I run to the library to return a book and run back home again. I run past the Undertakers that used to be a pub, which my husband and I once fantasized about owning. I run through the present and into the past, running past the house we used to live in and streets my children used to play on. Perhaps I'm running into the future, past schools they may one day attend, churches they may marry in, houses we might live in one day in years to come. In the summer, when the evenings were long and my energy greater, I ran past Pierce Park, up the hill and into Marley Park. I would run through the park, slowly, slowly, as the path inclines, and out the other end. I would think about all the walks I have done in the park over the years, with my children when they were small and a trip to the park was a day's event, with a friend during COVID when it was the highlight of the week. It's remarkable to me, the fact of this running. At school, I loathed the cross-country running sessions we were forced to do during PE classes. Cross-country being something of a misnomer, given we were doing short loops of a small satellite town in the northeast of England and not long-distance runs up hills and down dales. Surely these sessions were designed as a punishment by some evil PE teacher. I could barely get through one without doubling over on the side of the pavement, clutching my side due to cramps. Who would ever do such a thing voluntarily? After that, I tried running several times as an adult, but was never able to manage it. There was always some message my body would send telling me to stop. This is not for you. Shin splints and fallen arches, heavy legs and your face overheating. Then last year, some random Wednesday in July, I decided that walking wasn't enough. It was important to me suddenly to get going, to move faster. I needed a buzz that my usual trudge around the neighbourhood couldn't provide. So I started to run. First, as far as the second lamppost, and then as far as the roundabout, then the petrol station, then the park, then round the park, and back again. My favourite place to run now is Montpellier Hill, up to the Hellfire Club at the edge of Dublin suburbs, where city becomes countryside. I run up the hill, slowly, very slowly. You might hardly call it running if you saw me. When I get to the top, I can look down on all of Dublin, the city, the bay, the Poolbeg Towers. Then I take a deep breath. I will probably take a photo or two, and turn around and run faster on the way home, because it's all downhill from there.
Soft, dark rain misted on soft, dark nights, like a gentle country voice with none of the insistence of the cold city. I love the dark under lights so you can see it, the wet foliage glistening in the damp, dark, mild evening, prelude to dark you can't see. The time of the dark nights is magic for me, October, November, December, January, when fallen leaves are mulchy with falling rain. I was born in November, and I feel the dark time of year in my blood. I was born in a rainy city and moved to a rainy countryside, from Manchester to to Sligo. Rather, I was moved. I was 6 years old, myself and my sister squished in the back seat of a boxy Morris Traveller, transported like the stacked boxes by our sides, squashed together. I've a memory of wearing the itchiest pants known to time. It's my abiding memory. Extremely itchy, uncomfortable pants. On a drive from Manchester to the ferry and o'er the sea by ferry, then from the ferry and on to Sligo. Considering the length of my life, it seems I have few memories. 10 a year? How life lived evaporates in the darkness of the mind. I remember the city lights bright, then disappearing as the night reclaims the space, and then again the city lights, and then the dark, like long, slow blinks over the vision of space and time, the slow blink of time. Do I remember, or do I recreate, from other times, from the times of others? As a comedian, I replicated that night journey, coming back from shows all over Britain to my then home of London. From trains and cars, the lights gathered round cities and towns like ancient armies encamped, waiting till daylight to invade. Or I'd take night planes, moving between Ireland and England to work, seeing from above the black cloth of places, a giant jewellery box with the twinkling diamonds of urban lighting systems. Where is memory seen from? My father travelled all over Britain in the 50s and 60s, painting giant cinemas. He spent months painting the Forth Bridge in Scotland. We have memories and memories of memories, and rememberings of rememberings of rememberings. This is our personal history, pillars we hold tight to in the choppy waters of life as they become part of our identity, the illusion of who we are, buried in the swampy waters of the past. A hugely uncomfortable journey at the dark-nighted time of year, October to early November. I know, because not too long after we arrived in Ireland, I had my 7th birthday, November the 6th, 1971. And the car drove into the giant garage of the ferry, and we went upstairs to the cabins. Did we have a cabin? My mother had a cabin once in the 50s or 60s with her friends coming back from work in England to Mayo. Is that what I'm remembering? No clear picture of this ferry, just a construction from all the other ferries from different generations. And when I go there and try to shine a light, the mind reflects back a dark abyss which represents most of what I thought and did and lived. The night sea choppy with its crashing crests of foam. It's funny how little we remember of most of our life. Where does all that living go? Once upon a time, 2 weeks ago to be exact, I was in a sweet shop, one of those that recreate ye old sweet shop that used to exist, or did they? And there I saw it, a rich toffee globe with a dark brown glow and a stick you held to give it a lick. Treacle. That's the lolly I had in my hand one Guy Fawkes night in Manchester. My mother holding my other hand. It was bonfire night and a friend's birthday. I remember being small and pulled through the night with fireworks going off in the dark skies and into the sitting room lit and warm with the young birthday boy and friends and back out and falling in love with the dark and the warmth and the light come to life only in relation to the dark, to luxuriate in one wrapped in the other and the world is endless and huge as a dark sky to the small boy handheld, with no worry of how or where he was going.
The 2nd of February, 1914, marks a significant event in cinema history. On that day, an English comedian first appeared in moving pictures in a short film called Making a Living. He played a charming swindler called Edgar English and sported a top hat, a monocle, a large drooping moustache, and a cane. The picture received a moderate response, although the actor playing the swindler was singled out for praise. His name was Charlie Chaplin, and little did cinema-goers know that February 2nd that worldwide fame for him was just around the corner. Before joining the Keystone Film Company, Chaplin had been on his second exhausting tour of America with music hall impresario Fred Karno's theatrical troupe of comedians. Charlie was the young star of the show, which was full of talented performers. One possibly apocryphal story goes that one time he decided to take a few days off, feigning illness and letting his understudy take over. Then, on hearing that this understudy was getting bigger laughs, Charlie made a remarkable recovery and returned to work. The said understudy, Stanley Jefferson, would also be wooed by the cinema and would later change his name to Stan Laurel. While February 2nd was a significant date in Chaplin's professional career, the 1st of February, St. Bridget's Day, could be said to hold a special significance in his personal life. St. Bridget was reputed to hail from Louth, and in the mid-1930s, Dundalk playwright Paul Vincent Carroll wrote his play Shadow and Substance, about an old priest's housekeeper, also called Bridget, who has visions of her saintly namesake. The play was first performed at the Abbey Theatre in 1937, and the following year, a production in America played for 8 months on Broadway, winning the New York Critics Circle Award for Best Foreign Play. The great part of the old Canon Skerritt was played by Sir Cedric Hardwicke, and young Bridget by Julie Hayden, who, incidentally, went on to play the first Laura Wingfield in The Glass Menagerie by Tennessee Williams. Having finished work on The Great Dictator in 1941, Chaplin was looking around for a new subject, and Sir Cedric suggested Shadow and Substance. No doubt recognizing in the canon a wonderful part for himself, Chaplin spent the guts of a year writing a screenplay adaptation. Always on the lookout for young female talent, he was introduced at a dinner party to a teenage actress called Una O'Neill, daughter of playwright Eugene. Thinking her perfect for the role of Bridget, he also fell madly in love with her. And they planned to marry once filming of Shadow and Substance was out of the way. However, while they did indeed get married and lived happily together until his death on Christmas Day, 1977, plans to film Shadow and Substance were shelved, and Chaplin made Monsieur Verdoux instead. But back to February 1914, and within a week of that inauspicious debut film, two more Chaplin films were released, Mabel's Strange Predicament and Kid Otto Races in Venice, California. For these pictures, however, Chaplin had found the baggy pants and tight coat, the small bowler hat and large shoes, the little moustache and cane that were to become his trademark look. The little tramp was born, and Chaplin's fame spread the world over, making people laugh and cry in equal measure. On a personal note, my grandfather, as a young man, played violin in the Cozy Corner Cinema in Armagh, his sister Bella on piano, accompanying the latest silent movie releases, many of which no doubt featured The Little Tramp. I like to think of my grandfather fiddling away there with a smile on his face at the antics of the little man on screen. And when my grandfather married and became a father, his first child, a son, my father, just had to be christened Charlie.
If you're ever in a hurry, driving in County Kildare, don't go through the Curragh. Why? Sheep. Yes, sheep rule the roost on the Curragh of Kildare. They're everywhere. They love to graze on the broad swathe of crunchy short grass. Well, they're herbivores after all, and the Curragh is commonage, so that whenever and wherever sheep are grazing, they are perfectly within their rights. The rules of commonage state that there can be no fences to keep the grazers in check, and sheep sometimes tend to wander. An open garden gate along the road is considered to be an invitation to lunch, but they return to their home ground, for there's no better grazing than on the plains of Kildare. Sometimes when I pause there, I find myself humming one of my favourite pieces of music, Bach's Where Sheep May Safely Graze. They're placid creatures, and yes, indeed, those sheep can take a while to decide whether to cross the road or not. They might even change their minds in the middle of the road and rest there. Nothing will move them. They can even stop a tank in full battle mode. And tanks and other armoured vehicles appear regularly on the Curragh. All 5,000 acres of the Curragh belong to the Department of Defence. For hundreds of years, soldiers were trained there, but it was when an official camp was set up to prepare troops for action in Crimea in 1854, it became more permanent. Eventually, better living quarters to house the soldiers were constructed in glorious red brick. Today, you must take heed of red flags and sentries who warn you that you could be in danger when too close to a firing range. You might come across a line of soldiers weighted down by huge backpacks jogging across the flat land. Night manoeuvres are usually silent and can be a bit daunting if you're confronted by a platoon in full regalia. Sheep rolled up like white fur cushions sleep their way through it all. But the Curragh is a lot more than grass, sheep and soldiers. I heard a discussion on radio a while ago about the dwindling supply of fresh water in Dublin. A contributor to the programme suggested that the Curragh could be drained to solve the problem. And I wondered, where is the water to drain from the Curragh? Apparently the Curragh is an aquifer. The definition of an aquifer, I'm told, is a body of porous rock, sand and gravel saturated with groundwater. Water enters it as rainfall and seeps through the soil. It can move to all the nooks and crannies and resurface through springs and wells. I wonder, would the whole Curragh collapse if that water is drained to supply the city of Dublin? The meaning of the word Curragh is a place where horses race, and they certainly do race there, big time. One of the most delightful sights I have ever witnessed was on an early morning walk. I heard what I took to be the sound of thunder, when out of the morning mist a herd of seemingly wild horses came toward me. Sleek thoroughbreds they were, their riders putting them through the exercise regime for the races to come. Oh, yes, the Curragh is not just grass and sheep. You'll find wildflowers in certain areas. The golden furze is overabundant and has to be cut back occasionally to keep it in control. There are wild orchids, bog cotton, sphagnum moss, and blushing wax-cap mushrooms to be discovered if you know where to look for them. And all the while, the great round tower and medieval church watch over the Curragh from a distance. Bridget's legacy to the plains of Kildare, as her feast day is marked with national celebrations. The Curragh of Kildare is not just grass and sheep. It's valued greatly for its archaeology, its aquifer, its mysticism. Oh, I could be here all morning telling you about the military museum, the strangely hilly golf course, Donnelly's Hollow. Come someday to where sheep may safely graze and see so much more.
The winter it is past and the summer's come at last, and the birds they are singing in the trees.
This week, these last few days of January slipping into February, I've been putting away the candles and candle holders. Most of them, I've kept a few out. We've lit a lot of candles this winter, their flames glowing inside heavy glass tea light holders, blue and yellow, shining white in proper candlesticks, refracted and broken into gleaming shards from within the cut glass candle holder my mother gave me. And outside too, on frosty nights, shining inside the IKEA lanterns in the garden. Lots of candles. We've turned the lights off and struck a match instead. We've gone with the grain of the season. We've relaxed into this time of shadows, putting up no resistance. We've let winter enfold us. Shadows. This winter, I've been reading In Praise of Shadows, by the Japanese writer Tanizaki. This book does what it says on the cover. It reminds us that shadows and darkness are necessary elements of life, that a point of light will shine all the brighter against a deep velvet backdrop. Tanizaki writes about the place of shadows in domestic life, in public spaces, in music and literature and film, in the quotidian, the everyday. Reading this book, I was taken back in my mind to a shadowy side street in Japan, in Kyoto, strolling with Japanese friends, commenting on the dimness of Japanese streets and streetlights, which runs so counter, of course, to our idea of Japan as a place of neon, of flashing lights, of brilliant illumination. As we walked along this side street and chatted, a geisha emerged from the darkness, clacking on her wooden shoes, her face white like a ghost, going about her business against the context of shadow, and then vanishing into the shadows again. A little learning that I carried home with me, that darkness brings light to life, so that, yes, this winter I've embraced the darkness, or rather, embrace the effect that tiny points of light can have on darkness, bringing restfulness, atmosphere, ease, banishing the gloom. Were it not for shadows, Tanizaki reminds us, there would be no beauty. Of course, we already know all about this in Ireland. We always did, even if modern life has sometimes come close to making us forget. So many of our seasonal traditions are attuned to the balancing of light and darkness in our lives. And I'm mindful of this deep past,